Welcome back to the Self-Sovereignty Podcast, everybody. Today we're with Bill Etheridge. Bill is a politician, formerly a member of the European Parliament for the West Midlands region. He's now currently a member of the Brexit Party. Bill, thanks a lot for sharing some of your time. Thank you. Can you give us some of your history, like before you became a politician and stuff, for a bit of context?
Yeah, I went to... When I was a young man, I went to Parkfield School in Wolverhampton, just down the road from Sedgley, where I'm mainly based nowadays. And then I got into the steel industry. I did 20 years in the stainless steel and aluminium industry, buying and selling. And I eventually got into politics around about 2009, because for the first time in my life, I couldn't get another job during that recession. So I was just looking for something to do, and I started volunteering, doing voluntary work at the time with the Conservative Party. And they took me on and hired me as a campaign executive. And then the whole history sort of carried on from there, of leaving the Tories in 2011 and joining UKIP.
What made you join UKIP at the time?
Well, my political beliefs are best sort of summed up by a little bit of a cross of Reagan and Thatcher, and that's why I joined the Conservatives initially, was because I thought that's where the home of that sort of right of centre, relatively libertarian type thinking was. But it clearly wasn't. I mean, during my time as a Conservative, I got to meet David Cameron, Boris Johnson, George Osborne, you know, some of the movers and shakers, and they were not my definition of Conservative. Plus, I think, probably causing some ructions in the local Conservative Party, I was an ambitious bloke. I'm trying to get ahead and trying to do things and whatever, and cheesed a few people off. They caught sight of the fact I was involved in the campaign against political correctness. And one of the things that we did in that campaign was people of all ethnic backgrounds were taking photos with gollywog dolls. And it was a part of it was like a montage of different people. And the idea of it was to talk about how political correctness changes the perceptions. I mean, I'm 50 now, and to people of my age, gollywogs never crossed our mind. It was supposed to be anything offensive to a black person. It was, a toy, a doll. And we were discussing the changes in the perceptions. Because that photo got seized upon, I was reported to Conservative head office as being a racist. They suspended me and my then wife without a hearing. And at the same time as that, I'd spoken to some guys in the local UKIP who'd been, thinking the same way as me politically. And also I was fortunate enough to meet Nigel Farage. And I had a good chat with Nigel. And, I could see that at that point, UKIP was a right-of-centre libertarian patriotic party. Mm. And that's where I felt that I could make a good impact. So that's how I moved on to there.
Right, and since UKIP, I think you had a brief stint in the Libertarian Party, didn't you? And then moved into the Brexit Party after that.
Yeah, well, sadly, when UKIP, after all its trials and tribulations, got taken on by Gerard Batten, someone I've known for many years, Gerard's opinions and views are not what I associated UKIP as being. He's very much a nationalist, and he's some of his views on culture and race are not the kind of thing I believe in. And I couldn't. He changed the party so much. I couldn't represent something I didn't believe in. Otherwise, I'd just be the same as every other politician. So I left UKIP. Got offered the opportunity to join the Libertarian Party. Thought it would be a good idea for two reasons. One, to totally distance myself from what was happening with UKIP. But two, to get a little bit of media coverage on libertarianism so people would actually start to look into it. Mm-hmm. But as a political party, the Libertarian Party, it's got some great people in it, but the people at the top don't really run it as a political party. I think they prefer it to be more of a talking shop. And I've always been more about trying to crack on and do things rather than rather than just sit around chatting. So it wasn't really for me. But it highlighted libertarianism for a brief moment and got people, a few people talking about it. So, you know, I'm pleased for that, at least.
Yeah, because it's a bigger movement in the States, really, isn't it, libertarianism, than in the UK? It's not that well known here.
Well, yeah, I've met up with some of the people in the American Libertarian Party, and they do incredibly well by comparison. And they're, in the last election, their vote share amongst the under 30s was considerable. I think it was somewhere near double figures, which, you know, for a nation of the size of the United States is remarkable. And although all university and further education campuses have their share of left-wing activism, libertarianism in the States is big on the campuses, and they make a big impact. It dies off with the older people because I think it's more a case, you know, the two-party system. They think, well, we've got to vote for someone who broadly represents us. But they're a big noise over there. They're a significant party and very, very important in the shake-up. So it's something that gave me hope because, yeah, you know, if they can do it there, then why couldn't we try here?
What about, I think in the States, they've had like people like, is it Milton Friedman and Ayn Rand and people like that who a lot of the people in America sort of, but that's very different. We can see that there's a far left wing indoctrination of stuff. This is something that we agree with here. You know, in the individual rights rather than like a collective mindset. But do you notice a big difference between that in the States and that in Britain?
The difference between the libertarian movements, you mean?
That philosophy, like.
Well, in the States, a lot of it is based around their constitution. The people I met who were the libertarians there were very, very tied to the constitution. And, of course, we don't have a written constitution, which is something that I regret. I wish we did. But they've got something to hang their hat on there and something to stand for. But also, you know, they've got a different... It's a whole different societal vibe going on over there. You know, there is a belief in personal freedom. It's, you know, their young people have that taught to them. Whereas I think here we don't get that sort of thing. We get more of a case of, oh, you're selfish if you try and look out for the individual, and oh, we should all be, you know, joining in and paying for everyone else. And that isn't really a predominant feeling in America. It's more about self-respect and personal pride and look after your own, which obviously I feel very good about and I'm very much on side with.
Because I remember from years ago, you're quite a polarizing figure locally. And yeah. Why do you think that is? Is it because you actually speak what you're thinking? Because politicians generally, they just talk around things, don't they? They don't answer questions. And they get a bad reputation for that. But I think, from my perspective, you're polarizing in the sense that you say things that a lot of people agree with, but that's always going to separate, isn't it? You're always going to have people who do and people who don't. But I've heard you're a racist, you're a fascist. I've heard all this, and I've never heard anything like that come out of your mouth. So it's like...
No, I think what it is about the polarizing is in this country, and particularly since the 90s, in this country, we've got used to politicians who try to reach a consensus and a middle ground and who don't like to necessarily be seen to have any principle that's guiding them. They try to appear more pragmatic. And that isn't why I did it. I did it because I believe in things. So if you believe strongly in something, passionately in something, and let's not forget, you know, I come from an inner city comprehensive and 20 years in the steel trade. So I'm a blunt talking person. I don't couch it in terms to try and avoid offending people. I say what I think, and they can take it or leave it. And that's, for me, that's not being rude or disrespectful. That's actually saying to people, this is what I believe in. Now, I'm being honest with you. And if you believe the same, then you can back it and vote for it. And if you don't, you can vote for someone else, and you've got the right to do that. I've never tried to hide who I am, my mistakes, my life, my beliefs, because that's not fair on the voters. They need to know the bloke himself, you know, and many of the local pubs around our area, people come up to me even now, really, when I'm off the scene to a degree, people come up to me and get chatting about politics with me, and that's right. I think that's the kind of thing that they should all be doing. But it's a lot easier not to, because if you never say anything that means anything, you can't cheese anyone off.
Well, exactly, and it seems at the moment, in particular, like for example, Boris. I find it embarrassing the way they've handled the current situation. I think it's just an absolute joke. But they seem to be saying things just to pander to the masses. They're not saying anything that they hang their hat on.
No, they're not driven by principle. And one of the things about Boris is that he's not a man, I don't believe. I mean, I've met him briefly a couple of times. He's not a man that I believe is driven by a guiding principle of anything other than the fact that, you know, he should be in office and the Conservatives should be in power. And broadly, he's a kind of modern, liberal kind of bloke. He doesn't have any strong passion. And he only really, as far as I'm concerned, got involved in Brexit because he could see it was a way for him to get on. I'm glad he did because it's weighed some votes. But, you know, he's not a driven man as regards ideology. He's driven as regards Boris Johnson should be Prime Minister, which, in fairness to him, is only the same as Theresa May and David Cameron and John Major. You know, the list of these, Tony Blair. You know, all these people, the thing that really drives them is the pursuit of power and position rather than the pursuit of an ideal or a dream to improve everyone's lives. And that's just modern politics.
So how do you think, like, the coronavirus and COVID-19, how do you think that's been handled?
Well, I think, first of all, I'll cut some slack. It's a situation that no one expected to come along, and you know every country in the world has gone down a certain route. But having seen how things have developed and looking at the figures for the deaths, and again, not wishing to sound heartless, I don't want anyone to die, but you look at it and it's the old, frail, vulnerable, and ill who have been dying from this. It isn't an illness that it would appear from the figures is killing too many people who were fit and healthy and less than 60. Now, the reaction to that has been to completely destroy the economy, to completely set us back at least 20 years and maybe more, and put us in a position where we're going to have a recession, which could well go into a depression, the kinds of which nobody alive has ever seen before. I think that is utterly irresponsible and dangerous, because more people die of poverty than anything else. And we are purposely setting ourselves down the route to poverty. So frankly, whilst I have some understanding for the difficult position the government's been in, what they should have done when it started to become more clear was to put what resources need to be put into the NHS and the nursing homes and let the rest of us get on with working to pay the massive amounts of tax all this is costing, but also to allow us to get on with our lives and to try and improve our situations. This is going to hit everyone, particularly the poorest, the hardest, and I think it's an absolute shambles. I'm totally against lockdown of any format being continued, because underneath the guise of lockdown, the rules that have come in are fitting of a totalitarian state. And it's very sinister, because when are these rules, all of them, going to be relaxed, or are they ever? It's very, very dangerous. And frankly, lockdown should be abolished immediately, in my view.
And I think a lot of the science is pretty baseless as well. It doesn't seem to have come from any... like you can never say one certain person has said something. They always say the science says this. So you can never actually put your finger on where that's actually come from. Like the two, what the fuck's that?
Yeah, it's just made up. It's made up. The rest of the world's doing 1 meter, and we're doing 2 meters. Now, they say, well, you've got less chance of catching it. Well, yeah, well, why not make it 100 meters? Why not make it, you know, a mile? Of course, if you don't go anywhere near anyone, you're not going to catch anything. But that's not how life works. You know, we have to work as an economy that's joined up, and we have to be able to be in contact with other people. And if that means that we risk getting a nasty virus, well, you know, it ain't smallpox. It's not the Black Death. It's a nasty virus. We should just plow on. That's my opinion anyway. I don't understand people should shield. I mean, my own parents are being shielded, but they are in their mid and late 70s, and they aren't particularly healthy. That makes sense. And they're also not productive members of society anymore in terms of the economy and finance. Well, of course they should be shielded, but the rest of us, let's get out there and get to work.
Well, I just think, why don't we just give people the choice, the individual right to go, if you're okay with it, you crack on, open your businesses and you open for trade. But if you're not, if you're worried, these are the statistics, you know, feel free to stay at home. I don't see why that couldn't happen.
Well, I don't either. And I think the vast majority of people in a very short time would be back to cracking on with life and as it should be. I mean, you know, we're here talking now. There's football matches going on today with no crowds, with no people in pubs watching them, with all the finance and all of the... There's economic value to it. There's also societal value to the fact we all get together and share our common interests. It brings us together. If you keep us partitioned away from each other this way, our differences are harder to overcome because we don't get to talk. But also, you know, we're stopped from properly gathering. You know, the famous thing that pubs are little local parliaments. Now, we're stopped from gathering and talking and understanding what's happening in our lives. It is on every level wrong.
I agree. You mentioned the economy a couple of times. I don't think we've actually felt the full effect of it yet because of the furlough scheme and the amount of money that they're just printing and pumping into the economy and whatever. How bad do you think that could get and when?
Well, there's two ways that this could go. You're right about the furlough scheme. When that starts being wound down towards October, the end of the year anyway, there's going to be millions more on the unemployment register. There's no doubt about that because I've spoken to some company and business owners who are only really keeping people on at the moment because of that. And as soon as it finishes, they may shut their businesses or they'll get rid of the people. There's many of them going to do that. So the figures, I think, by the end of the year are going to be catastrophic. And I think that we will start feeling the effect of this over the next couple of months. And then people will wake up to the fact that the government has run up unprecedented debts to pay people who are effectively unemployed. That's the reality of what's happening here. And then you've got the fact that the Bank of England and other central banks around the world are printing money to buy up government debts. Now we're heading towards a situation where you could have entire states and governments owned by the central banks because they own their debts. And there's a lot of talk and something I'm looking into at the moment of this talk of global reset, where these debts get wiped away, we think, but actually they're owned by a handful of gigantic banks and bankers. And when you're in that position, then democratic governments don't really govern properly anymore. And I started off hearing about this and I thought it sounds a little bit like a grim, paranoid conspiracy. But then you start looking at these figures, and it's only this week another 300 billion in quantitative easing in the UK. And it's starting to tally up. It's starting to make sense. And it's not something that we want. I mean, the other alternative is that they're going to kick the can down the line with these government bonds, war bonds, so to speak. But none of it is real. None of it is actually dealing with money and with commodities and with people as real things. The reality is we've overspent massively. We should be cutting back massively to balance it, but we won't. It won't happen. What's going to happen is we either lose our freedom or we'll have generation after generation after generation paying back this debt, and all for a few months of protecting us from something with the death rate of less than 0.5% from what I last saw.
Because I think the in the US, the Fed have, I think the balance sheet's about 10 trillion or something now. And the people's going to be paying that back.
Yeah, eventually we will. And it'll come in ways that, you know, that over a long period of time with increased taxation and increased regulation and increased state, that no one ever voted for, no one ever asked for, and it's going to be there. It can't be got rid of now.
So what do you think is the solution to that? Well, I suppose, what's your thoughts on the banking system in general, the central banking system, because they've got that much power and control?
Yeah, it's a major issue that it's not something that I think one or two of us can come up with a solution to, because the power and control of these central banks is already there. It is already so great. Now, the only way that it can be undone, really, is by resetting the system to a degree. But there's a danger here in all of this, because they're taking this power by printing so much money. Anyone who looks at history and looks at Germany before the war and the Weimar Republic, where so much money was printed for their debts that they ended up with hyperinflation. And at the moment, we have no inflation because the economy is basically dead. They're pumping money into a corpse that's sort of jerking and jolting from time to time to show some activity. But in reality, when the economies do wake up around the world and these vast sums of money, if they're still in circulation, get ready for inflation that will be another major issue. So how we deal with it, that's something that I must say is going to take greater minds than mine. I've pinpointed the issues and the problems, but the actual solution to it is something that I'm still thinking about working on myself. But I know we're heading to a dark place and it's going to take something radical.
Yeah. Do you think we'll hit a depression?
Yeah. I think that there is no doubt at all that that'll happen. I think that by this time next year, we will still be in the throes of a serious economic depression. Unless something happens that you know, some genius stroke from somewhere that I'm not aware of, every understanding I've got of the history and the laws of economics suggests to me that we're heading to something where people will understand what genuine poverty is.
All for this lockdown. Crazy. Absolute crazy.
Well, it is madness.
How do you think Donald Trump's doing over in the States?
I think that Mr. Trump has done some things very well. Some things very well. Like for example, the way the economy was going prior to this, he'd done some great work. And I've been over to the States and met some congressmen and senators a few times while I was an MEP. And they were telling me how he's really ripped a lot of government out. A lot of the state control, a lot of bureaucrats have been replaced, got rid of, you know, in a pretty quick and almost violent way. You know, he's torn apart, which is great. I think that there's a little concern in my mind that he's political rhetoric and political approach may make it very difficult for him to win re-election if the economy is in the state that I predict it will be in. And that worries me, because he's not the kind of guy that appeals to swing voters. You know, he might win them over if they've got a job that they didn't have before, or if they're earning more money. But in terms of his personality, like you said earlier on about people who divide opinion, he divides opinion, and there's a lot of people who might have voted Republican that perhaps wouldn't now. And that's a worry to me, because the last thing the world needs is America to fall to the left.
Mm. But Joe Biden, to me, whenever I listen to him talk, he seems like he's, how do I put it, decent. It looks like he's losing his marbles a little bit. Can't string sentences together or anything.
It's the people behind him that are the key, though. You know, Joe Biden is a typical establishment politician who's there to put on a front and a face, dress in a nice suit and have his nice hair nicely coiffured. He's not he's not the guy who's making the decisions. And the thing to watch out for is when they pick his running partner, because Joe Biden's pretty old as well. So the chances of him being fully in charge of America throughout the whole of his term would be quite slim. I'd keep a very close eye on that running partner.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. Because obviously, that's where I saw Donald Trump come into power. I think it was 2016. I thought, that's an anti-establishment vote, what's going on there. And same as the Brexit, in my opinion. It was just like an anti-establishment. People have had enough. So I was quite happy when he got elected. But there's a lot of people now sort of seeing Donald Trump as like the saviour of Western civilization, this, that, the other. And I don't put him in that category, you know, although I don't think that he's being puppeteered. I also have the other side of the coin where I think presidents have been, they're chosen by people above them. And he's Donald Trump.
Many of them are. I think he may have broken the mold to a degree, but I think since he's been in, they've tamed him quite significantly. The one thing I will say is that most presidents, prime ministers, world leaders, it's their second term that defines them, because they've then got the strength of a second mandate and the knowledge that they're not going to be standing again, and they can really leave a legacy. Yeah. So I think the judgment of Mr. Trump comes if he gets that second term, what he does during that, that'll be where his place in history is marked out.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see if the economy does fall on its arse. It'll be interesting to see how he handles that, because everything with Donald Trump is based around the stock market and the real estate market and all that, isn't it?
That was his big card. 6 months ago, I was totally confident he was going to win again. Totally confident. In fact, and I've been several times to the States in recent years, and I know that whole areas were so solidly behind him. That, you know, the Bible Belt, the Rust Belt, there's so many places that were behind him, and the economy was really booming. And even people who didn't like him personally, and there's many of them, they were going to vote for him because he was making them richer. Mm. Now having lost that card, it's a little more questionable.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. What are your thoughts on this big movement, the Black Lives Matter thing that's happened at the moment and everything to do with it? I know it's a very big question.
Well, there's two parts to the answer. The first part is I agree that Black Lives Matter, as do White Lives and Yellow Lives and Brown Lives and Polka Dot Lives. All lives matter, obviously. The movement itself is a hard left revolutionary movement. And as far as I'm concerned, it's people are being manipulated by exactly the same people who manipulate the climate change alarmism and every other effort to bring down our system. They're being manipulated by money and forces from the hard left to, you know, convincing people that they're so hard done by that they've got to take action straight away, that we must defund the police. I mean, what an insane idea that is. I mean, what's the alternative? What we're going to have gangs on the street, or are we going to have...
Well, they did in America, didn't they? They had that little area in Seattle.
Oh, the free zone, or what it's called. I mean, this is madness. You can't do that. And then they're talking about bringing down the capitalist system. The capitalist system that maybe they need reminding has brought the highest standard of living for people who live under it anywhere in the world at any time in history. This is the thing. And they're all going about how hard done by they and their ancestors were. And let's be honest, a lot of white people's ancestors were hard done by and poor as well. But we'd be a damn sight worse off now if we didn't have capitalism. You know, the only thing communism ever does is make everyone equally poor, except for the people at the top who absolutely lord it over everyone else. And it's like Animal Farm, you know, some pigs are more equal than others. And so to be calling for that and manipulating people the way they are, this is where I've got a big problem with Boris Johnson. He's a conservative prime minister with a proper majority. He should be going out there and arguing right of centre, conservative views to counter this crap. And he's not. No. He's actually allowing his people to condone it and speak about it. And then, you know, we're going to have, you know, we've got Premier League footballers with these slogans on their backs. I mean, it is outrageous. And these are the same Premier League footballers, by the way, who weren't allowed to wear a poppy because that was political. Yeah. You know, so the whole thing, as far as I'm concerned, needs exposing, and it needs politicians with a pair of balls, because you will be called a racist. There's no doubt about it. Anyone who stands against it is going to obviously be called a racist. Same as anyone who stands against the crazy Greens is some kind of oppressor who's burning fossil fuel every 2 seconds. It's all easy there to throw at you, but you've got to have the guts to stand up to it and say, I'm sorry, mate, that's absolutely rubbish. This is the reality. This is what these people are trying to achieve. And by doing it, they're going to make us all worse off.
Mm-hmm. How do you personally deal with, like, because you must have had a lot of it over the last 10 or so years, that you're a racist. I mean, I've been called racist in all sorts of these last few months. And at the beginning, it's like, what are they on about? I haven't even said anything. So how do you personally deal with that now?
Well, the racism accusation, I can laugh off because, and actually it's probably one of the reasons why I've often done things that people could throw at me with being racist, because I know for a fact that coming from where I come from the centre of Wolverhampton, going to the school I went to where white people were minority, there is no way on earth you'd come out the other side of it being a racist. In fact, none of us had, when I was at school all those years ago, none of us had a bad word to say to each other. We used to get on great. In fact, I used to play, when I left school, I played for a pub football team that was run by Indians, and I learned the Punjabi words for a white bastard, because that's what I was referred to. I was referred to as the Gura, you know, and none of this bothers me in the least. And I can, you know, I'm quite happy for anyone. In fact, one of the times I was campaigning for UKIP in Dudley, it was one of the funniest things that's ever happened to me, is that when I get out in the sun, I go very brown. I'm quite a brown-skinned bloke in the first place. I was campaigning. I went up to this bloke and I said, look, you vote UKIP? He said, yeah, I will do. He said, I've got to do something. He said, no offence to you, mate, but I want to send all these blacks home. You think I'm black, do you? He said, yeah, of course you are. And at the end of the day, you know, as far as I was concerned, it's laughable. It means nothing to me. I've been to parts of Africa where they've thought I was an African. I don't care about race. I really don't. You know, the Martin Luther King line about judging people on their character or on the colour of their skin, that's what I care about. I couldn't care less about colour. So I can laugh that bit off. The one thing over the years that really hurt me and offended me, and I was genuinely upset, was when I was being accused of being a Nazi. That really, really upset me. Because I'd done a seminar for the youth wing of UKIP, and they'd asked me to talk about public speaking, because at the time I was going round, I was Nigel's warm-up man on his big events he did, and I did a lot of speaking. So they called me to talk, and I did a seminar or a lecture, which was very similar to what I'd been taught when I was working in the steel trade about public speaking. And I went through people who were good communicators. Now, Martin Luther King, Tony Blair, even, you know, these aren't people I necessarily agree with. Obviously, Churchill. And I also mentioned about Hitler, who, you know, whatever anyone says about the bloke, and he was, you know, most likely him and Stalin are vying for being the biggest monsters in history. He was a very good public speaker. Because
phenomenal
he got
public speaker.
He got tens of thousands of people to turn up to rallies. He came out with the most, in my opinion, outrageously crazy ideas possible, but persuaded people they were a good idea. That's brilliant public speaking. And I highlighted the fact that at the start of a speech, and this is something that teachers often do now, he would stand in front of the people and not speak. He'd just look at them with an intensity, and he'd wait until they thought, well, what's this bloke selling? And, you know, they'd actually be focused in on him, wanting him to speak, and then he would start speaking. I mentioned that. Of course, there was a Daily Mail reporter there, and the next thing I know, there's a headline saying, MEP tells UKIP youth wing to emulate Hitler.
Oh, yes.
But you know, being someone of a libertarian mindset, to be compared to such a monstrous mass murderer who also believed in overriding power of the state in all things, that really did get to me. That was hard to get over. And in fact, I've got to thank Paul Nuttall, who was at the time deputy leader of UKIP, who phoned me up when I was at my lowest ebb on that one, and cracked a few jokes with me, and actually said, am I through to the evil Nazi headquarters? And started laughing at me. And it brightened the mood, because that's the one thing that's really, really got me down. you know, basically because it's accusing me of something that I'm totally against in every possible way. But, you know, these things stick.
The irony is a libertarian is the polar opposite of what a Nazi would stand for.
Exactly. You get that, but you try explaining that to you know, most people on the street who haven't really got the time or interest in politics, and it's not an easy one to talk around.
Mm. Yeah. So you mentioned the media there. I have not got an ounce of time for mainstream media. Do you think they've been infiltrated by like a far left Marxist organisation?
I think they're all working towards a common purpose, and I use those words absolutely advisedly, common purpose, which I think has infiltrated the media, the arts, culture, education in every respect. There's no two ways about it. They are left-wing big states, all of them. And you could flick between the channels, because I've tried to do it, because I must admit, I'm getting older now and I'm less patient. And I get angry watching the news. So I keep trying the different news channels, and every one of them is spouting the same crap, the same approach, the same line. And, there is definitely an infiltration. I'm not so sure it's Marxist hard left as much as I'm sure it's a big state nanny controlling influence there. And I'm absolutely convinced that that's going on. And by the way, it also goes into the drama output, because anyone who watches the soap operas, the characters who are good are always women or gay or ethnic minorities. And the characters who are bad are almost always white working class men. And there was a classic episode I saw of EastEnders around the time of the referendum, or just after it. There was a horrible white working class woman who's been really rude and nasty to this very polite, charming, educated Muslim gentleman. And she actually said at the end of it, "Oh, I'll be glad when we get Brexit and we can sort you lot out." Now, that was in a drama output, but that is exactly how they wish to characterise it.
So what's the agenda?
Well, it's... I believe it's one world government. I believe it's the whole concept of everything that, you know, United Nations, EU, all of these organisations, in order to try and bring control so that independent sovereignty and independent democracy no longer has any pull. And certainly my experience of the EU is that it's a double bluff, actually. Because a lot of what they put forward is this left-wing big state claptrap. But actually, you know, the people it's suiting the most are global corporations, because it's homogenizing people across all these different countries to accept similar standards of living, to accept similar commercial practices. And it suits the corporations because they can then work on this global scale. And of course, it screws up and causes trouble for small to medium-sized firms who would be the competition. Mm. So I believe there's a front of this social democratic left-wing nanny state, and behind it are global corporations who are absolutely lapping it up.
Mm. Would you be able to name individuals doing this, or do you think it is a collective corporative?
It's collective. I mean, I can give you a little example to prove out my argument. There was a directive went through the EU while I was there to change the branding on cigarettes. And it was another one of these, you know, if you smoke a cigarette, your head's going to explode, all the normal garbage. And but of course, they were saying it was all a health, it was sort of for the good of everyone's health. And then it turns out that this branding was costing so much money that several small to medium size cigarette firms were being driven out of business because they had to take on new lines and things like that to do the branding. Mm. And then you look further, and who was behind the lobbying for it? The big tobacco firms. They were the ones who were lobbying for it. And it was going through all the health committees. And it was clearly just a trade ruse to screw up the smaller competition.
Mm. And do you think...
And it got through, of course.
Yeah. And the EU, obviously you've had a big... You've got a lot of experience in that arena. Brexit's meant to be the end of this year. Is everything on track, do you think?
I'm surprised to say that it's looking quite good. And that is one area that I'm genuinely, genuinely surprised, really am. Everything coming up, I mean, I met Barnier, the EU negotiator, a few times. And I can tell you that guy is red hot. He's brilliant. I'm not, you know, I've got the respect for him, even though he's on the other side. He is one of the slickest, smartest, smoothest, well planned and thought through guys you'll ever meet. And for the fact that he appears to be squealing a bit now in the face of this new UK negotiator, Mr. Frost, and the fact that these deadlines for extension are being passed and so on, I'm feeling quite excited about it. I think the odds are what we will end up with is that both sides will blink and there will be some kind of trade deal, which won't be ideal in my opinion, but it will be better than what Theresa May was trying to do. But I think there's a growing chance that we might achieve what I believe to be the promised land of no deal. And if we can get no deal, then the opportunity for the British government, if it has the balls to grab it, is vast. We can totally shake up the way our countries run. We can outcompete them on everything. And we can trade with the rest of the world on whatever terms we choose. It's very exciting. That's the one thing happening in the world today that I'm really excited about.
Yeah, because we don't, because everyone's just in mass fear at no deal. I think it's just a fear of uncertainty, aren't they? They don't know what's going to happen. So everyone just goes, oh, no, forget that.
The thing with trade negotiations that most people don't get is that they're not actually about trade. that's the thing about it. I mean, I sat in on the EU and America, USA trade discussions that they were trying to put through, which didn't work out. And the actual commodities and trade involved was a secondary thought. What they were negotiating about was quotas of different genders and different ethnicities in government departments. They were talking about emissions policies and making sure that everything was done in a green way. They were talking about changing the regulation in America to make it fit in line with the EU regulation on employment laws and things like that. Now, that's nothing to do with trade. And realistically, if you strike a trade deal with someone, you're having to bend the knee to a degree to take in some of their political objectives. Whereas if you have a no deal and go on WTO rules, well, then you can trade with the EU on the same terms as countries like China and America, who, you know, if you think that that's a problem and we're not going to get any, we won't be able to export anything to them, ask yourself, how many times do you see made in China on things?
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you can't trade on if you don't have a trade deal. It's not the same thing.
You mentioned China there. What are your thoughts on China as a political power? Because they hold a lot of weight, don't they?
I think the Chinese Communist Party is the biggest threat to freedom in the world today. I believe, and this is, you know, I've got no insight into this, but it's personal belief. I believe that the coronavirus is man-made. I believe, from what I've looked at, that it came from that lab in Wuhan. I'm 50-50 whether it got out accidentally or whether it was on purpose.
Yeah.
And then you look at how they're profiting from this situation. The West is distracted and looking at its collapsing economy, its social upheaval and unrest. And at the same time as that, the Chinese make incursions into India. They're threatening Taiwan. They're trying to take over Hong Kong. The Australian government have been very diplomatic about it. They've just been under an enormous cyber attack, saying it was a nation that did it, but they haven't said who. Well, it was China, because the Australians have been at the vanguard of actually, you know, making arguments against us, China. Next thing you know, they're under attack. This is very, very serious. And I think we need to identify China for what it is. And I think that Mr. Trump particularly, but certainly Boris on our side as well, need to start talking to the Chinese in a way of saying, look, you know, we are not just economic powers. We are military powers as well. You need a little reminder just to understand the fact that we are not going to get walked over here. And I'm very concerned that we could enter an era of Chinese dominance, which You know, the Chinese communists, for them to have world dominance, to be the predominant superpower, terrifying.
It is terrifying, and I'll put that on my social media a lot. We need to keep our eye on China because people just don't get it. If it's not rammed in the face, they just won't look. And as you mentioned earlier about India, I think Putin actually come out with something last week back in India in that. So I think that was probably a good sign if it is what the media have come out with. But I think they're one of the biggest threats, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and the problem is, I mean, you mentioned Putin there. I've been over to Russia as well, and I've spoken to people who are to do with the Russian government. And I've been at conferences and meetings where people who the West has fallen out with, the Russians have funded them X amount of billions of rubles or whatever. And they are now there. They're filling the gap. They are getting these people from these countries referring to Mother Russia. Now, whilst I don't believe that Putin is an immediate or clear threat to us in any way, shape or form, I don't want the Russians to fill the gap that we're leaving by our poor foreign policy. This is a very dangerous situation. Add all these things together. Russia being rather expansionist, China being aggressively expansionist, and the West in decline, economic and social turmoil. If we're not careful, these are the ingredients that lead to wars.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. A guy I look up to quite a lot said, if you want to know what's going on in China, take a look at the Japanese news, because they don't get on with one another. The Japanese will tell the truth. And, I don't think they even locked down Japan. I don't think Taiwan locked down.
No.
So they must know something that, you know, we're not knowing here. All this was a bit of a charade.
But there's definitely more to it than meets the eye. And I think, you know, many countries who haven't locked down, if you look at Sweden, for example, their curve of the virus deaths that went up and came down at the same time as ours with no lockdown.
I think they might be planting seeds already, though, in China, because they're talking about Beijing. There's more cases in Beijing and this, that, the other. Do you think they might be planting seeds for a second wave or no?
Well, the thing is, when China gives reports on death tallies and anything else, you can't trust what they're saying because the Chinese government lies, quite clearly lies. So any figures that come out of Beijing, frankly, I don't analyse, think about or care about because they're lying. Right. It's as simple as that. I think that if they want a second wave, they can see that quite easily by just popping a couple of people on a couple of planes. There's no issue with that. I think the fact that people died from it in China as well, it could indicate it was an accident again, but it also could be a great way of avoiding the full responsibility for their actions. Because, you know, if no one in China had got it and it's all broken out in the rest of the world, but we traced it back to that lab in Wuhan, the response from the rest of the world would be a lot more severe.
Yeah, and I don't really tend to think the Chinese, the Communist Party over there really care too much about the people over there, to be fair. That they're happy to take a few out just to get to their end political goal.
Communists never do. People are just numbers, the communists.
And you had, you mentioned Hitler and, was it Stalin or Lenin earlier? Well,
Stalin.
Look at Mao, Chairman Mao.
Yeah.
And he was the founder, if you like, of the Chinese Communist Party. Well, there's no one, in my opinion, more brutal than him. And that's the very foundation of the politics that's over there right now.
Yeah. Well, the communist movement in China, Russia, and in various other places around the world has killed millions of their own people as well. You know, and they've done it without any thought or hesitation because communism dehumanizes people. So, you know, if a few million have to die for the greater good of the party, then so be it, in their view.
But you've got kids coming out of university here who have got hammer and sickle on the T-shirts.
They don't understand. They've been taught. They've been given a nicely whitewashed version of all of history. Of you know, the Nazis were the ultimate villains, and the communists. But if it wasn't for the Russian communists, we wouldn't have won the Second World War. I've heard this spouted many times. The education system, you talk about infiltration, that has been infiltrated from top to bottom. And some of the kids coming out of schools now and colleges and universities are absolutely convinced of certain key things, which at the very least are arguable. I mentioned climate change. They're convinced of that. That, you know, if you drive a car, you're the devil. they're convinced the EU kept peace after the Second World War, despite the obvious fact that it was nothing to do with the EU and it's everything to do with NATO. They're convinced the British Empire was evil through and through with no redeeming features. And they're convinced that if it wasn't for Russia and the Second World War, we'd have lost. You look at all these things that they're being taught as facts, which are at best arguable theories. And no wonder we've got an issue with so many young people going out there and falling into the clutches of BLM and climate extinction rebellion and all these other crazy organisations. It's no wonder that they've been primed, ready for it.
I suppose it always comes back to the why. Why, how and why has that happened? Do they want a communist society, a totalitarian society? Is that what they're after?
The only way you can, right, it's been proved out time and time again that the only way you can beat Western powers like the United Kingdom and the USA has got to be through other means than military, because we, you know, the war angle's been tried and it doesn't work. So if you want to bring down these countries, you've got to do it from within, and you've got to make them to the point where their own people hate themselves. And I don't think it's as sinister or as obvious as, you know, spies spreading the word or people being employed to do it. I think it's a subtle form where there are enough people in these countries who believe that our system is wrong, and they spread the word very effectively, and they're embedded in systems where they have a captive audience, and they continue to hammer this message home. Because if a population of a country hates the past of the country, believes it's evil, then they're more likely to give way and allow that nation state to cease existing. And, you know, what Enoch Powell famously said that those who the gods wish to destroy, they first make mad. And, you know, a quote from Greek times, I think. But it's true. In order to destroy us, we are being driven mad, collectively mad, by this insane propaganda that goes as education. And I could accept it if it was just put forward as an argument. My favourite teacher at school, a history teacher, was a self-avowed Marxist. But he put forward the arguments and then put forward the counter-arguments, and we all debated and discussed it. It was brilliant, brilliant fun. Mm. But nowadays, they only see the one side of the argument.
Mm. Yeah, Karl Marx with the Communist Manifesto. So there's you can't get much more communist than that, right?
No.
And that's everywhere. I watch these videos in America, and they're on the campuses, and like, if you just say anything that they don't agree with, they automatically throw out like you're this way, you're a fascist, you're this. And it's just like, man, we can't even debate anymore. You can't even have a civil conversation with anybody.
Well, you're not allowed to. They're cutting people off. I mean, even on social media now. Well, I've met Katie Hopkins, and I don't like her, and I don't like much of what she says. But she should be allowed to say it, and she's just been taken off Twitter. You know, she's a nasty, offensive, obnoxious woman who does it, I think, just to make a name for herself. Having said all that, I'd fight for her right to do it.
Freedom of speech is definitely it's under attack, isn't it?
Absolutely. And freedom of speech, freedom of culture, freedom of belief. You know, going around and trying to attack Churchill's statue and all these other things. And if you stand up for it, you say no. I mean, I watched veteran servicemen going down to London to protect Churchill's statue and saw them described as far-right extremists. It's madness.
Incredible. Incredible. Bill, it's coming up to the hour, mate. Is there anything you want to say in closing?
Only that you mentioned at the start I'm in the Brexit Party. I'm not. I'm not with the Brexit Party.
Okay.
Yeah, that's all right, because I agree with their goals about Brexit, but not any of their other policies.
Right, okay.
But the main thing I would say to anyone is that if you believe like-minded to anything that I've said, it's more important than ever now to stand up and start talking and to say and to risk the names, the abuse, the being cut off social media. It's more important than ever to do it, because if we don't, if we all just meekly stand by, we're in a changing time now. This could be a moment in history that could be looked back on as one we lost. At the moment of our greatest victory, Brexit, it could all be turned against us, and this could be the moment of our greatest defeat. So we've got to keep on shouting from the rooftops and risk pissing people off, because that's just a bit of bad luck. You know, you've got to say what you think. You've got to stand up for free speech.
Yeah, that's always going to happen. You're always going to piss people off, and it doesn't matter. Any belief does that.
Exactly.
Bill, thanks a lot for your time, mate. Really appreciate it.
No, my pleasure, mate. My pleasure.
Cheers. Thank you.
Good luck with everything.
Thanks. Cheers. Bye-bye.